Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today, it's our monthly book show, and the theme is America, the 250th birthday celebration just around the corner. Joining us, Jill Erickson, retired reference librarian. Hi, Jill.
Good morning, Mindy.
And Autumn Hassett, executive director of the Catuit Library. Good morning, Autumn.
Good morning.
All right, so we're hearing a lot about America 250, and I can see from the piles of books in front of you that this was not a very difficult task.
In a certain way, it was very difficult because there are so many books, and there's so many that go far back, and then there's this huge group of new books because headed towards, and it's a big decision as to which you bring.
Yeah. All right, let's get started. See how many of these books we can get through. What do you want to start with, Jill?
Well, I have to start with my most favorite book in the whole group for various reasons, which those of you who have ever seen this show may know about it. What I have in my hand is 1776, a musical play by Peter Stone and Sherman Edwards. And may I say, I first went to this play when I was very young, and it was at the Music Circus in Cohasset, and which had a go-round stage, so it just goes round and round. Anyway, my friend and I went to see this show, and it was the best show I'd ever. It still remains as one of the best shows. It was incredibly good. I have no idea who was actually who was playing what, but they were all so good. And actually, as the round, having it be going round, that actually sort of helped because they were all going, they were all talking about various things. And happily, as it turns out, this very show, 1776, will be at the College Life Opera Company in Falmouth next week. So, of course, I have tickets for that.
Of course,
but it's not going to be as good as that. I hate to say it, but because
it's going to be great, Jill.
It could be great. It could well be great just because of the songs. But the what I have is the script in my hand, which, of course, the Woods Hole Public Library has, is because they have lots and lots of scripts, should you ever need one. And here's just the beginning of scene one with John Adams speaking, saying, "I have come to the conclusion that one useless man is called a disgrace, that two are called a law firm, and that three or more become a Congress." And by God, I have had this Congress. For 10 years, King George and his Parliament have cullied and diddled these colonies with their illegal taxes, stamp acts, Townshend acts, sugar acts, tea acts, and when we dared stand up like men, they stopped our trade, seized our ships, blockaded our ports, burned our towns, and spilled our blood, and still this Congress won't grant any of my proposals on independence, even so much as the courtesy of open debate. Good God, what in hell are we waiting for? Which is a great opening for a show, can I just say? So it's worth reading it itself. This particular copy has photos of the show in it that was done very long ago. We've got Pennsylvania's John Dickinson. We have Richard Henry Lee reading the Virginia Proposal on Independence to the Continental Congress. It is a very fun show, but also very historic. I mean, it's got a lot of stuff. And there's at the end of this book, it says historical notes by the authors, and it says the first question we are asked by those who have seen or read 1776 is invariably, is it true? Did it really happen that way? And the answer is yes. So by all means, go see the show or just read the play. Get the music, which is also really fabulous. Right. It's 1776 by Peter Stone and Sherman Edwards.
Great. Autumn.
All right. So my first book is America's Founding Myths by Christy Mahaly and illustrated by Marta Sevilla. And this is a juvenile nonfiction book that explores myths in American history.
Oh, that's cool.
It's really neat. And I have a 7-year-old, so it's fascinating to learn about how he's learning history and how I learned history and how my grandparents learned history. And this book just goes through so many important parts of American history, like Paul Revere's Midnight Ride, the shot heard around the world, Plymouth Rock, and it explains where the myth came from and if it was true or not. But then in the back of the book, which I really like, is it talks about media literacy and information literacy.
Wow.
And how to question sources. And if someone says, I have 500 siblings, how you could go about verifying that for accuracy.
I love that book.
I do too. It's really fun. And it's a large book, but it's full of great illustrations. Yeah. It has some like pull down tabs, so it's interactive for kids. And I think it's fun for parents to read with their children. And maybe you can have conversations about how history you learned back in the day maybe was taught to you differently. Because when we think about America 250, it's not only a celebration, it's also a moment for us to rethink or revisit our beliefs and our thoughts and for the future. So
Exactly. This
is America's Founding Myths by Christy Mahaly.
Thank you. All right, chill.
Here's a book that I discovered. One of the great things about doing this show every month is you find books on the library stacks you had no idea existed. This is one of them that I saw for this show, which is 1776, The Adventure of the American Revolution, told with pictures by Irving Wurstein. And who I'd never heard of before, and I started to look into, like, who is this guy and what is he trying to do here? And basically, it is. This is how it was described, with its lively 20,000-word text, which I think is really hilarious. They tell you exactly how many words there are. Its detailed captions, read by themselves, they form a capsule history of the revolution, and its 300 carefully chosen pictures, 1776 portrays the birth of our nation so vividly that you feel you are living the days of the American Revolution yourself, which is a great little write-up for this song. And it is. It's really interesting. It has also sort of got, it's an old book here. It's sort of fallen apart, but it's really interesting in a lot of it being not photographs, but images. Here's one that I have here, which is of Dr. Joseph Warren, who sent Paul Revere to warn colonists that General Gage had ordered troops to capture guns and powder stored at Concord. Paul Revere, the man Warren had chosen to carry the message, was a remarkable individual, and it's a whole discussion about Paul Revere. He had many talents. He was not only a master silversmith, but a dentist, engraver, cartoonist, inventor, and goldsmith as well, which I have to say I had no idea until I read. It's interesting to see how much, given where you live, you know, and how much school you'd been through, that I would know more about Paul Revere than I do, other than, you know, he went on his horse and went around. But one of the things I discovered with this book is more about the fellow who put it together. And I discovered his obit in the New York Times. And he, Irving Wurstein, which is sort of off the line here, but an author of some 40 books, chiefly for young persons, died of a heart attack on Wednesday in doctor's hospital. He was 57 years old and lived at 511 East 20th Street. I love that they give his address. His experience as an infantry soldier in the Army in World War II and his work as a correspondent for Yank magazine no doubt had a major influence on his writing career. Many of his books concerned wars and battles of the past. So it's really sort of interesting. And again, never had heard of him, but he's written trillions of books, more or less trillions. but this book is just mostly fabulous because of the illustrations and what he has put into this book, so that you sort of visually can imagine what it was to be in the 1776 by Irving Wurstein.
Okay, thank you. Autumn.
All right, so my next pick is Tyrants and Rogues, Understanding the Declaration of Independence by Robert G. Parkinson. This is a brand new book, just published this month. I think I might have been the first one.
It looks very new.
And I thought this one was so interesting because most of us know the famous lines of the Declaration, life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. We know all about that. But I don't remember learning much in history class about the grievances against King George. There were 27 of them, and that's what really helped to form the Declaration. And so this book goes through each grievance in detail.
Wow.
And I just learned so much that, you know, some of the things that the king did that folks were really unhappy about and what led them to write these documents and really create this new future for America. And so it wasn't just philosophical. It was political so much in nature. And it was almost like a defense that the colony seeking independence was justified by these documents. So I would definitely recommend it if you're a history buff and want to learn more, especially about how, you know, King George was dissolving representative houses just because they opposed his invasions. I mean, you know, yeah. makes tons of sense. And he was using his veto power unfairly. There was a lot that he was doing that people didn't like. So I would recommend Tyrants and Rogues, Understanding the Declaration of Independence by Robert G. Parkinson.
Great. Thanks. Okay. Jill.
All right. Well, I'm now, this book you can use for exercising as well as for reading.
What is that, like 1,000 pages?
Unbelievable number of pages. What are 800? 818 pages. Ron Chernow's book, Alexander Hamilton. And the reason I chose this book was, of course, this is the inspiration that the musical Hamilton was based on.
Which was fabulous.
And yeah. Which is completely fabulous. And the genesis of Hamilton has already entered theatrical lore, as it says in this article, while on vacation. But I did not know how I knew some of this, but not all of this. While on vacation in Mexico in 2008, Miranda cracked Ron Chernow's doorstop biography, Alexander Hamilton, which was nominated in 2004 for the National Book Critics Circle Award and won the George Washington Book Prize. A few dozen pages in, Miranda's new project began leaping to life. In Hamilton, he saw a figure he recognized, a word-drunk firebrand with untrammeled ambition, raw talent, and outsized ego and a lust for combat, verbal and otherwise. Miranda saw a rapper, which I think not many people thought of Hamilton as a rapper, but he did. And it, of course, this gigantic book, if you want to take it to the beach, you can do that, but don't get sunburned because once you start reading it, it's hard to stop. It is, as Library Journal described it, a hefty biography of Alexander Hamilton. It makes the case for him as one of the most important founding fathers, arguing that America is heir to the Hamiltonian vision of the modern economic state. His sweeping narrative chronicles the complicated and often contradictory life of Hamilton, from his obscure birth on Nevis Island to his meteoric rise as confidant to Washington, co-author of the Federalist Papers and America's first Treasury Secretary, to his bizarre death at the hands of Aaron Burr, which, if you've gone to the musical, you know what happened. But it would be, you know, if you're here for the summer, this book just like just as well I think Miranda would appreciate your reading the entire book on vacation. So for those of you hanging out, Alexander Hamilton by Ron Chernow will keep you going.
It's the book show this morning, and our theme is America 250. 866-999-4626 is our number if you have a book you'd like to suggest for our show this morning. 866-999-4626, or you can shoot us an email, thepoint@capeandislands.org, and we'll have more after a break. Listening to The Point. It's our monthly book show. The theme is America 250. With us this morning, Jill Erickson, retired reference librarian, and Autumn Hassett, executive director of the Kituat Library. If you have a thought for us, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, Autumn, what's next?
All right. So one of my favorite parts about preparing for the book show is talking to our patrons and seeing what they recommend and
good idea,
their ideas.
Yeah.
And there's lots of teachers out there who have taught history for many years. And so this series was recommended to me. It's Chains, Ashes, and Forge by Laurie Halse Anderson. It's a trilogy series, and it's about enslaved individuals, indentured servants. It's historical fiction in the time of the Revolution, really geared towards young adult readers. And I think what's so interesting about it is it helps these young readers, when they think about our country that was founded on these great principles, to have them also understand that we did tolerate slavery and inequality in our history, and maybe help them think about, you know, the lessons that were learned along the way and how we can create a bright future. But also allows them to just think more critically, maybe when they're reading a book like this. When you think about what did independence mean to someone who was enslaved versus the person who was enslaving them, for example. And so this is a series Chains, I think, is the most well-known. It's the first book in the series by Laurie Halse Anderson, but then there's two others, Ashes and Forge. You can read them together or just the first one. So that was my next pick.
All right. Jill.
Well, speaking of books kids might be interested in, I brought with me a book that's been around a long time but is still being published. It's Johnny Tremaine by Esther Forbes.
Yes.
You probably read that. I read this.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, last night Jackson said, next book I want to read is Johnny Tremaine. I'm finishing up one of the I Survive books, and that's his next one.
Now, how do you think he heard of Johnny Tremaine?
From my husband.
Oh, all right. Well, it's very interesting to read, but it went, as I was reading, I mean, I remember reading this as a kid and thinking it was like the most exciting book I had ever read. It was so fascinating, and then what they've done with the book at this current time is it starts out, well, it's got some beautiful bookends. I mean, the paper's right at the front, beautiful Boston map. But one of the things that they do with this version of the book, and I don't quite understand, and you know, you've got kids, maybe you can display. At the very beginning of the book, they have Johnny Tremaine in cartoon version, but it's the actual book that they're putting the cartoon into. So I'm a little confused. Why do you think they do this?
I have no idea. It's not a graphic novel, but it's wants to start that way.
Is it because of the kids will open and go, oh, it's a graphic novel. Let's get this one.
I think that's maybe what's going on here. Honestly, I don't know. And there's a little bit more. It's sort of fun. The historical characters and story of Johnny Tremaine are in the back, so there are little comic illustrations of all of the people who are involved. So, and that's sort of good. I mean, that's sort of interesting. In any case, one of the things I found as I was looking, rereading this, which was not as exciting to read as I recall.
You're a little older, Jill.
I guess. I think this seems to make a real difference when you're reading. Although there's some, you know, I can read Little Women over and over again, but it depends on the book. But so what I found was the New York Times, talked about it in November 1943, and I won't read this whole thing, but it's sort of interesting how they write up what they were going to say about Johnny Tremaine. And it says, it begins, "The American Revolution has been of late a favorite gazing ground for novelists. During the past dozen years, epics and sagas have sprung up." And again, this is 1943, okay? "Epics and sagas have sprung up with the persistency of crabgrass, celebrating some campaign, probing some little-known aspect or a new point of view. Only a master craftsman and one who has worked so much in the period that it has become a kind of second home in time would dare to undertake that most familiar of themes, Boston at the outbreak of the war." Such a novelist is Esther Forbes, and to her story, she brings so much freshness and vitality that one reads it with the avidity with which one follows today's news, with the extra dividend of pleasurable recognition of half-forgotten episodes thrown in. The reason, of course, is that Miss Forbes not only knows the wharves, the inns, the very cobblestones of 18th century Boston about as intimately as her own backyard, but because she creates three-dimensional people. Historical figures are clothed in flesh as well as good broadcloth. Even casual street figures are endowed for the moment of their appearance with reality, and thus we see the temper of a city and a period. And one of the things I've learned from this is that, in fact, Esther Forbes grew up in Boston, so she had been, you know, she was already living there, she already knew what was happening, and in that sense, I mean, again, I think for kids, this actually would be very interesting. And there are lots of sort of scary things that happen during the chorus, and Paul Revere gets involved. And of course, the kid loses. I mean, the other part of this that I had not recalled, I think I just blocked various plots in this book, which is he loses one of his fingers because he's doing work for somebody and he loses some fingers. And so then he can't do what he wanted to do. But Paul Revere, you know, comes into the story. And it's so I think give it to your class and see what they think. And, you know, there are at least some comics in here. So.
Okay. All right. Autumn.
All right. So my next book is This Far and No Further. This is a book of photographs inspired by the voting rights movement by William Abranowitz. It's a hefty book here. And what I thought was so interesting about this book is the photographer, he found himself, you know, visiting locations that were associated with the struggle for voting rights. And he was in Selma, Alabama, 52 years after the historic marches. And he thought, how can I, through photography, share what I'm seeing today and connect to our past and just, you know, maybe make a message and share it with others. So he found himself, as he says, standing in places where hate reigned for decades, even centuries. And he began to realize just how much blood and turmoil were steeped in American history. And despite the beautiful landscapes and natural history of the South, there was this deep relationship with violence. And he met many interesting folks along the way. And if you look through it, there's just some great there's portraits, there's pictures of buildings, just different moments in the South and where historic events happened. But I thought it was a really neat representation when we think about America and we think about the power of photography and how it can convey a feeling that maybe the written word can't always convey. Yeah. So this is This Far and No Further, photographs inspired by the voting rights movement by William Abranowitz.
Oh, thanks. Jill.
All right. So I have a book entitled 1776 because
you got a theme going here.
Yeah, I do. And this is by David McCullough. And David McCullough is one of my, I just love David McCullough.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, in my ancient years when I was working at the Boston Athenaeum, he would be working on some book and coming in and I would be able to help him find stuff. And it was so exciting. And he's just the nicest fellow. And I remember when I moved down to Falmouth, he was doing a talk shortly after I had moved down. And after his talk, you know, I just went up to him and said, I'm so, you know, it's so nice to see you here. And he was like, well, it's nice to see you here too. You know, he just was like that. He's just a really nice fellow. Anyway, this book is David McCullough's winner of the Pulitzer Prize, 1776. And the epigraph is, "Perseverance and spirit have done wonders in all ages, General George Washington." And the siege, in the part one, the General George Washington on January 14, 1776 says, "The reflection upon my situation and that of this army produces many an uneasy hour when all around me are wrapped in sleep. Few people know the predicament we are in." And this book, of course, not surprisingly, got all kinds of great responses to it. Publishers Weekly wrote this, "Best-selling historian and two-time Pulitzer winner McCullough follows up John Adams by staying with America's founding, focusing on a year rather than an individual, a momentous 12 months in the fight for independence. How did a group of ragtag farmers defeat the world's greatest empire? As McCullough vividly shows, they did it with a great deal of suffering, determination, ingenuity, and the author notes, luck. Although brief by McCullough's standards, this is a narrative tour de force exhibiting all the hallmarks the author is known for, fascinating subject matter, expert research, and detailed, graceful prose. Throughout, McCullough deftly captures both sides of the conflict. Simply put, this is history writing at its best from one of its top practitioners." And that all is from a Publishers Weekly review. Everybody loved this book. Yeah. You may also listen, if you want to read this book, if you've not already, it's 1776 by David McCullough.
Great. Autumn.
All right. So my next pick, it's a little untraditional. This is a Route 66 Companion by David King Dunaway. I had to get it through Comcat, so you can't really see the cover that well, but it's just, you know.
Oh, that's yes.
Route 66. Yes. But when we think about America and our identity and the freedom to move and explore, I thought about Route 66 and just how iconic that roadway is. I found this book. And what's so interesting about it is this book combines fiction, poetry, memoir, and oral history. They're rather short stories, only a couple of pages at most. But they present all about this famous roadway in America. And there's stories from Joan Didion, Sylvia Plath, Washington Irving, John Steinbeck, and many, many more. And it talks a lot about our culture, as Americans, but it also tells the story of Native Americans and Mexican Americans and African Americans and how Route 66 kind of played a role in just in the coming of America and all of our cultures combined. So I thought it was such a neat, like a neat story and kind of fun for the summer to read.
Oh, so yeah, it's great because it's short little, you can
super
pick
short,
it up and put
right.
it down.
Yes.
And, yeah. So if you're busy, you got kids and you're at the beach and you can just read a couple pages and stop. Yeah.
Exactly. Yes. It's a great book for that. So this is a Route 66 Companion by David King Dunaway, and you can request it through Comcat.
Great.
Well, I've now also brought along a Ted Reinstein book, which I many of you may know. Ted Reinstein, he came to the library a lot of times to talk about his books. This one is Wicked Pissed, New England's Most Famous Feuds by Ted Reinstein, who's reporter for Boston Celebrated News Magazine Chronicle, if any of you watch Chronicle all the time. But this one has some pieces. Here it's The Shot Heard Round the World, Still Ricocheting is the title of this one, which is really apparently true. He writes, the same school children who can picture that first Thanksgiving can also recite one of poet Henry Wadsworth Longfellow's most famous lines, listen, my children, and you shall hear of the midnight ride of Paul Revere. And then in parentheses, which, like the popular Plymouth narrative, is long on uplifting sentiment, shorter on historical accuracy. It says, what's fact is that on the night April 18, 1775, Paul Revere rode west of Boston, warning residents that British regulars were marching toward the towns of Concord and Lexington, there to seize rebel arms as well as two of the Patriots' principal leaders, John Hancock and Samuel Adams. What's also undisputed fact is that just before daylight, en route to Concord, British regulars reached the town of Lexington, about 15 miles from Boston. What exactly happened after their arrival there and who played what role is how the rest of the day's fateful events unfolded is still very much in dispute and will never be definitively concluded. In fact, almost 250 years later, it remains a point of bitter contention to this very day, not between the British and the Americans, between Concord and Lexington. So, and then he mentions then in another piece that he writes, he name that hill correctly, please. On June 7, 2006, the TV game show Jeopardy went on the air prepared to do something unusual, allow more than one correct answer to the following question. British General Gage said of the June 1775 battle here, the loss we have sustained is greater than we can bear. Had the answer unexpectedly been, what is Breed's Hill? The contestant would have been correct. Even as most viewers would have wondered, where in the world is Breed's Hill? Alas, what would have been a rare moment for Jeopardy and an even rarer instance of correcting historical inaccuracy on national television didn't happen. What is Bunker Hill? Carried the accepted answer, because that's what they think of it. Yeah. In any case, Ted always writes fun books. This one is Wicked Pissed, New England's Most Famous Feuds.
Sounds fun. Okay. Autumn.
All right, so my next pick is the National Parks Cookbook by Nina Elder, Melissa Nefik, and it's recipe photography by Scott Suchman. I love bringing cookbooks and how seeing how they fit with our book show. But I thought this book was really interesting because it chronicles how national parks got started in the United States. And it started with Yellowstone, and then it goes through like the different types of food that were originally served at the Old Faithful Inn, and how railroad companies created some of the first facilities in Yellowstone National Park. But then it goes through many of the national parks and it pairs them with recipes. And it's just food that you could enjoy that's natural to that region, from that region. And it also pairs it with photographs of the national parks themselves. So if you happen to be in Bryce Canyon, which, like, that's just such a beautiful picture of
gorgeous.
Bryce, you might enjoy some Dutch oven potatoes. And it has a full recipe.
It also looks very good.
Looks very good. I thought it was just such a fun cookbook. I hadn't really seen one that chronicled national parks before and pairing them with food. So this is the National Parks Cookbook, and it is by Nina Elder, Melissa Nefik, and recipe photography by Scott Suchman.
Do you know if it has any from New England?
You know,
I just wonder.
It
if
has
they
Acadia.
Have... Oh, yeah, that would be.
Lobster stew and Jordan Pond House popovers.
Ooh. Oh, I've had those popovers.
Are they good?
Good. Right. I highly recommend the popovers.
What do we got next, Jill?
Well, the next one I have is you know, I felt like I need to bring a couple of poems. Now, the book I have in front of me is 500 poems, but I was very interested in some of the poetry here, and I've got one, which is Ralph Waldo Emerson, and I'd never seen this before, but it's a Concord hymn, and it says, Emerson spent most of his long life in Massachusetts, where he was born. He was a schoolmaster and Unitarian pastor, but after about the age of 30, earned his living as an essayist and lecturer. Although his poetry is respected, his fame rests much more on his peculiarly American labors as a thinker. It is to his credit that he was among the first to recognize the genius of Whitman. And this is called Concord Hymn, sung at the completion of the Battle Monument, July 4th, 1837. I will not read the whole thing because it goes on for a while, but here's a little bit of it. By the rude bridge that arched the flood, their flag to April's breeze unfurled. Here once the embattled farmer stood and fired the shot heard round the world. And another one that's in here, which I think a lot of people probably know about, which is, if I can get the book open, Paul Revere's Ride by Henry Wordsworth Longfellow. And as I read somewhere, really the only piece that anybody knows about this, how many pages is this? This is like, you know, three pages of poetry, is the first piece, which is, of course, Listen, my children, and you shall hear of the midnight ride of Paul Revere on the 18th of April in 75. Hardly a man is now alive who remembers that famous day and year. And nobody knows pretty much anything past that. Mm-hmm. And if you read the next bit, I don't think I've ever heard until I came across this. The next piece is, he said to his friend, if the British march by land or sea from the town tonight, hang a lantern aloft in the belfry arch of the North Church Tower as a signal light, one if by land and two if by sea, and I on the opposite shore will be ready to ride and spread the alarm through every Middlesex village and farm for the country folk to be up and to arm. And it goes on for several pages. But I think, I mean, it's a really interesting description of Paul Revere's ride, but really, yeah, people only pay to the first stanza.
How many people do you think would remember Paul Revere if it weren't for that poem?
How many people have...
Yeah, I mean, the poem is what made him famous, really.
Well, that's true. Yeah. That is true. Yeah. If this hadn't come along...
Yeah. You'd have to really study your history, I guess. All right, we're talking... this is a monthly book show. We're talking... The theme is America 250-866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. And we'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. It's a monthly book show. The theme is America 250. With us, Jill Erickson, retired reference librarian, and Autumn Hassett, executive director of the Catuit Library. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Autumn, what's next?
All right, so my next book is...
Hang on. Should I take a turn your mic?
There we
go.
There you go. I'm here. Yeah. My next book is Two Ships, the... Jamestown 1619, Plymouth 1620, and the Struggle for the Soul of America. Ooh. Another brand new published book this month by David S. Reynolds. And I think this book is so interesting because it took place more than a century before the Revolution, but it really helps us understand why the colonies in the North and South developed as they did in America. Two ships came to America less than a year apart, the White Lion in 1619 and the Mayflower in 1620. And they both had a different identity. There were different folks on the ships. But there was a lot of tension, a lot of push and pull. And this tension continued for years. And really, the author synthesizes that it's around social hierarchy. But as history progresses, we kind of stop hearing about the White Lion.
I was going to say, this is really interesting.
It was really new to me.
Mayflower is all we hear.
Yeah, we hear about the Mayflower. And he establishes that because in 1860, Frederick Douglass gave a speech attributing the Mayflower as the main source of human rights in America, citing the Bible, the Magna Carta, habeas corpus, equality in the eye of the law, and many more. But this book aims to review the division in America through the lens of each of the two ships. And he felt there was such an obsessive focus on Plymouth from America's early days, because most of New England, he said, was quite frankly pretty messy. Our history was messy. There was a lot of exploitative trade with the West Indies. There were a lot of wars with native tribes, and it was easier to focus on the success, in quotes, of Plymouth and really prop that up there. So I thought this was really interesting,
interesting.
Timely to come out. So this is Two Ships by David S. Reynolds, brand new.
All right. Chill.
That looks quite fascinating.
I know. I'm going to have to check that one out.
Worth looking at. Well, I have here now my dearest friend, Letters of Abigail and John Adams, edited by Margaret A. Hogan and C. James Taylor. And they're just beautiful letters. I still remember, and people were doing paper letters, mm-hmm. and I love paper letters, and I love reading them, and they really write beautifully to one another. Here is a little bit. They're all lovely. This is Abigail Adams to John Adams, Sunday, June 18th, 1775. Dearest friend, the day, perhaps the decisive day, has come on which the fate of America depends. My bursting heart must find vent at my pen. I've just heard that our dear friend Dr. Warren is no more, but fell gloriously fighting for his country, saying better to die honorably in the field than ignominiously hang upon the gallows. Great is our loss. He has distinguished himself in every engagement by his courage and fortitude, by animating the soldiers and leading them on by his own example. A particular account of these dreadful, but I hope glorious days will be transmitted you, no doubt, in the exactest manner. The race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, but the God of Israel is he that giveth strength and power unto his people. Trust in him at all times, ye people, pour out your hearts before him. God is a refuge for us. Charlestown is laid in ashes. The battle began upon our entrenchments upon Bunker's Hill a Saturday morning about 3 o'clock, and has not ceased yet, and is till now 3 o'clock Sabbath afternoon. There are all these sort of lovely letters that they talk to one another, and that they are nowhere near one another for much of the time, mm-hmm. and yet the letters get through, which is one of the great things about this. And I was reading a review in the New York Times about this collection, and they say... The author of this article says he was her Lysander after the Spartan hero. She was his Diana after the Roman goddess of the moon. She called him my dearest friend. He called her Miss Adorable, and his heroine, who sustained with so much fortitude the shocks and terrors of the times. He, of course, was John Adams, the brilliant, charming, often irascible revolutionary patriot who became the second president of the United States. She was Abigail, his spirited, stoic, and equally brilliant wife. The two were not just what one television dramatization of their lives all too glibly termed America's first power couple, at a time when most women were accorded little power or influence. They were also uncommonly well-matched partners who shared a passionate dedication to the revolutionary cause, as well as a love of books and history, a playful sense of humor, a voluble literary gift, and deep and abiding affection for each other. Because John Adams' work as a critical player in the War of Independence frequently took him away from home, his correspondence with Abigail, some 1,160 letters between them have survived, provides a wonderfully vivid account of the momentous era they lived through, underscoring the chaotic, often improvisatory circumstances that attended the birth of the fledgling nation and the hardships of daily life, from smallpox to wartime shortages in that age of trial. Mm-hmm. It's really the all of them are really interesting. I've not read all of these letters, but you can drop in there mm-hmm. anywhere and find some wonderful thing that one has written to the other. It's my dearest friend.
Yeah, so amazing that those letters, you know, that we that they remained, right?
That well, and that
didn't
they
destroy them along
saved
the way.
Yeah. Their letters is really incredible.
So
as
great.
Somebody who has also saved her letters, I can say, and it's great to have your letters from, you know, decades ago. Especially as anything that comes through the computer often just vanishes. Yeah. But letters, paper letters, hang on.
Okay, Autumn.
All right, so my next pick, it's also another non-traditional pick, but this is America's Classic Ballparks by James Buckley Jr.
Oh, fabulous.
And this is celebrating parks of past and present. I'm a baseball mom now, so this is really fun to read through. But baseball has been called America's pastime for so long, and ballparks are more than just sports venues. They are the most celebrated athletic venues in the United States. I don't think there's anything quite like a ballpark and that feeling you get. And Buckley captures that so perfectly. And in the book, he says, after all, the whole object of the game is to go home. And I think that just made me feel that feeling you
get,
right?
That's great.
And the first ballparks, they were built in the early 20th century. Two of the original six are still standing. Happy that Fenway is one of them. It tells the whole story of the Green Monster and how Fenway came to be and many of the iconic players who played in that stadium. But baseball also represents just all of the people in America coming together, whether they're, you know, from America or tourists, people visiting, generations of families attend games together. We have immigrant communities who embrace baseball. Military personnel play baseball overseas. It's really a sport that anyone is welcome to play and loves to watch and just be together. And so we have Jackie Robinson, too. I mean, so many important moments in history in America.
Yes, yes. Although it's
baseball.
Very hard to be watching Red Sox right now.
This is true.
Very exciting when they're winning.
Yes. But this is America's Classic Ballparks, Celebrating Parks Past and Present by James Buckley Jr.
All right, Jill.
Okay, here's another book about the ride of Paul Revere and the night that saved America by Kostya Kennedy, which is, again, we sort of have, we come back to this because it was very key to the whole, and also to the mythology. I mean, everybody knows about Paul Revere, right, and the horse. And here's part of the review from Bookless Review. Kennedy presents a richly detailed, congenial, and dryly humorous account of Paul Revere's 1775 ride to Lexington and Concord and his legacy. Kennedy clears away sound bites and sentimentality shrouding Revere to present a fully formed account of the prosperous silversmith and patriot's life. Revere's legendary ride was actually his ninth. His longest was to the Continental Congress in Philadelphia, which I had not heard of before this. As Kennedy chronicles Revere's world, he profiles such fellow revolutionaries as John Hancock and Sam Adams and their British opponents, including Thomas Gage, and discusses the roles of women and enslaved people. Writing throughout with wit and insight, Kennedy greatly expands our knowledge and understanding of Revere's famous ride, placing it in a vividly realized historical context, the perfect read to mark the 250th anniversary of this foundational act. It's The Ride, Paul Revere and the Night That Saved America by Kostya Kennedy.
All right, thank you, Autumn.
All right, so this next book is George Washington's One-Man Army, The Life, Legend, and Battles of Peter Francisco by Admiral John T. Palmer. He's a retired from the U.S. Navy. And when I found this book, I had never heard of Peter Francisco, unfortunately. But I think that sometimes, you know, when we're looking at history books, we hear about some of the big names. We don't always hear about some of these lesser known folks who really made a difference in the American Revolution. Peter Francisco was born in Portugal. He immigrated to America as a child and became one of the Continental Army's most celebrated soldiers. And so this is an interesting story, a biography about his life. And he earned the admiration of George Washington. Story. So this is George Washington's One-Man Army by John T. Palmer.
Interesting. All right. Chill.
Okay. Well, this one is by Nathaniel Philbrick, who is, I'm sure many people know of Nathaniel Philbrick or have heard him read.
Yes,
Bunker
sir.
Hill, A City, A Siege, A Revolution is what this is called. And it is a... Because here's a bit of his preface. Because a revolution gave birth to our nation, Americans have a tendency to exalt the concept of a popular uprising. We want the whole world to be caught in a blaze of liberating upheaval. with appropriately democratic results, because that was what worked so well for us. If Gene Sharp's From Dictatorship to Democracy, the guidebook that has become a kind of Bible among 21st century revolutionaries in the Middle East and beyond, is any indication, the mechanics of overthrowing the regime are essentially the same today as they were in the 18th century. And yet, given our tendency to focus on the founding fathers who were at the Continental Congress in Philadelphia when all of this was unfolding in and around Boston, most of us know surprisingly little about how the Patriots of Massachusetts pulled it off. And it's got great reviews. Choice says, Nathaniel Philbrick has long demonstrated a rare talent for bringing new perspectives and sparkling prose to iconic episodes in U.S. history, which he certainly does.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing. Any book you read of Nat Philbrick's, is he always finds these little tidbits that you didn't know before. His research is just so great that, it's you think you might know this topic, and then you read a book he's written about it, and it's great.
Absolutely true.
Yeah. All right. Autumn.
All right. So I have, this is a juvenile fiction book. This is What is the Constitution by Patricia Brennan DeMuth. It's part of the Who HQ series. So it's really popular for kids to explain history, biographies, all kinds of fun stuff, but it's in a nice packaged format for young readers. And this book goes all the way through the creation of the Constitution. We follow from the Revolution, trying to understand why the first documents that were created didn't really work for our country, because the government had basically no power that they had created. So it couldn't really do anything effective. And so coming in, our founding fathers really needed to figure out a better plan for the country. So they gathered in 1787 and drafted a new document. But one of the things I also love about this book is there are some great historical photos from the past, including suffragettes celebrating the passing of the 19th Amendment from 1920. And I just think that picture is so joyful. And there's a lot of interesting photos of historic documents and some paintings that are hanging, in some special places in Washington, D.C. and Philadelphia. So great for young, curious readers who maybe want to learn more about our history and are new to learning about the Constitution. This is What is the Constitution by Patricia Brennan DeMuth.
I want to mention another a kids series. Nathan Hale's Hazardous Tales. Have you seen those? Are graphic novels, and it's written by Nathan Hale. So Jackson loves these, and I will tell you, when he was still in elementary school, I think it was the third grade, they dress up as historical characters. He chose Nathan Hale because of these books, right? So the premise is Nathan Hale's about to be hung, for being a spy, but they wait because he's telling them all of these great stories. So each book is, a different story about a different, point in history and battles. And they're a lot of fun. If you have something quick, Jill, we have about a minute and a half.
I will just say that I just want to mention again this book, 1776, The Adventures of the American Revolution by Irving Werstein, which begins the brewing storm from 1770 to 1775. One could sense the unrest, the threat of violence, and the bitter wind that whistled around the chimney tops of Boston, Massachusetts on the evening of March 5th, 1770. The city was an unhappy place that bleak winter. One seldom saw a smiling face in the streets. Even the children were dour and sullen. The Crown's taxation policies had brought on the universal dissatisfaction, and agitators such as Samuel Adams kept inflaming the colonists' ill will.
All right, and just a reminder, as you mentioned at the top of the show, College Light Opera doing 1776.
When is that? It starts this weekend, I believe. Yeah.
Okay, so check that
out.
Or
it may be Monday it starts. It's very soon. It's next week. I know my ticket is July 4th. So. Okay.
Perfect for that weekend,
yes.
Right? All right, Jill Erickson, retired reference librarian, and Autumn Hassett, executive director of the Catuit Library. Thank you both so much. We'll have a list of all the books we talked about this morning up on our website a little bit later today. We got to pull it all together, so give us some time. I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by me, Amy Vince, with production assistance from Dan Tridle and Elsa Partan. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.